ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
As we started to try to select these songs to go through with you, every song I considered, I pretty much decided every song is about time for me.
Well, that's probably why I gave you the theme, because I can tell you're a really big fan of time.
But it didn't help me narrow it down. And you know this, because even though this show is five songs, could we give you five? No, we gave you eight.
At least 20 acres and one gin and mule from the Alabama Trust.
Years ago, the world met Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. Their debut album, Revival, under Gillian's name, introduced us to an incredible storyteller, singer, and guitarist. And in the 3 decades since, they've swept us away in song. The love for them in Australia is immense, so it's a joy to have them finally take five. Welcome, both of you.
Hi, it's good to be back.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
When you look back at that time that's passed since Revival, does it feel like 30 years? Does it feel like 3 decades?
Not really, but I do recognize that we've done a lot of stuff. You know, I have many stories that fall into that time, and so it must have been 30 years.
Can you remember what your ambitions were when you put out that first record together?
I don't think we had any real thoughts of much of anything. We wanted to be playing music, like, professionally.
And yeah, I wanted to not have a straight job. Mm. You know, that was a definite, you know, ambition.
We were playing music that was not at all in style in the mid-90s to be trying to, you know, put this kind of American folk and bluegrass and whatever we were thinking of it as to make that your calling card in 1995 to be making a record was a pretty unusual choice.
Yeah, which is good to remember, you know, because even I'll never forget that first time we played the Newport Folk Festival, Nora Guthrie, Woody's daughter, happened to be there. And when we came off the stage, she'd been watching our set, and she hugged both of us, and she was kind of misty-eyed. And one of the things she said to us was, "Do you realize you're the first artists I've seen here today playing acoustic instruments?"
Wow.
And this was the Newport Folk Festival, but this was how kind of out of style, out of fashion acoustic music was at that point in the 90s.
Well, and even like a revivalism thing of wanting to do things with microphones and not pickups, or just like kind of liking some of the old ways, that was particularly out of style.
I'm an orphan on God's highway, but I'll share my
had a lot to do with T-Bone Burnett. He heard our music and thought that it would be best suited by this, you know, recording technique that was already really not what people were doing. We started recording to tape, and in fact, you know, a lot of that first record was mono, and he had gotten a recording engineer by the name of Rick Pekonen, who was completely capable of doing live mixing to tape. You know, just an extraordinary, what I'll call old school recordist, who had started when a sound engineer was still wearing a lab coat.
Yeah. This just gives so much more weight to the title of that first record being Revival then. You know, there is an ambition in calling your first album Revival if you're coming up in the mid-90s going back to the old ways of recording and presenting the world with this. And then, of course, now with the benefit of hindsight, we see three decades later, that really worked out for both of you, didn't it?
It did. It. That title actually came from a dream. Have you heard this story?
No.
We're not very good at titling. It's a little bit of a bane for us. I don't really enjoy it, you know, putting the label on the thing. And we couldn't think of a title, and we were down to the wire, and the record company was saying, well, we're just going to call it Gillian Welch, because you won't give us a title. And so we had about 12 hours left until they were going to have to turn in the title. And I took a nap, and I had a dream about a down by the river, kind of a country baptism thing. And I woke up and I said, how about revival? And that was that. We called it in and we made it just in time.
It's like a movie scene.
Yeah. It was. It was really crazy.
No, and it is particularly funny when, if you could have seen the list or the amount of thinking that we'd done and the number of words and going through all of the songs on the record and even songs that weren't on the record and looking at everything there and just trying to find something that felt appropriate. And then the decision was made in 1 second. As soon as Gillian suggested that, we knew that was the right word.
We're so funny, too. We're such weird people. Part of the reason it was good was the way those E's looked with, like, the E in Welch. You know, it's like we have to write out our names in the title and actually look at it to sign off on it.
You know, it was funny, like, for a long time, we kind of knew that Revelator would be kind of the title track of that album, but couldn't really figure out, didn't want to call that much attention to the song, and then, you know, had thought about all of these things, and then finally came up.
We thought we'd pull out a lyric, right? Times the Revelator, but that didn't look good.
Yeah, we didn't like it, and then I thought, and I remember sitting in the back of the car and saying to Gil, this is it. It's called Time. The album is called Time, and then we put the Revelator in parentheses to separate it from the album title, which is in technically Time. And then it is neither the title of the song, but all of the...
And not a song lyric.
Right. And all of the songs on that album are connected in our minds to that theme of time.
I'll never forget that. You were in the back. I was driving. And you had to explain to me, you know, you didn't write it down.
No, I was like, no, the parentheses, this
spoke
is perfect.
It to me. Time, and then parentheses, the Revelator, close parentheses.
And every day is getting straighter. Time's a revelator. The Revelator.
Well, time in title, and also your ruminations on time have always swirled in your songs and everything that you do. I think we're making that very clear in this conversation. You obviously also love old-time music. You take your time in getting your own songs right. So, yes, for all these reasons, I've given you the theme of time for your take five. And your first choice is from the legendary blues man, Robert Johnson.
Well, it's hard to tell, it's hard to tell, when all your love's in vain. All my love's in vain.
Why did you choose Love in Vain?
It is an incredibly concise and expanded moment of time. It's so emotional and visceral and visual, but it's quite a small moment, the way he walks you through it. You know, they walk to the station. They stand on the platform, and then she's gone. And it's just a beautiful, it's like a little gem.
And there's this beautiful conciseness in that song that really makes you feel this one tiny moment. And it reminds me of a lyric that turns up in so many songs, which is one foot on the platform, another foot on the train. That shows up in so many songs because that moment of transition between coming and going, that moment of transition between being in one place and then stepping into motion is just a powerful feeling for people. And
you know it's perilous, and you know it has limits.
Right.
That train's going to go. Mm. The way, the everydayness of what he talks about.
Mm.
He's got the suitcase in his hand. He's watching the light. He sees the train pull into the station, and then he watches the lights go. And it makes the refrain, "All my love's in vain," it makes it hurt all the more.
And you only see the objects around the lover who's leaving.
Yeah.
You don't know anything about them, which is also an incredible choice, you know, to make. It's not to say a word.
And that really rings true with moments like that, where I almost interpret it as, it's like he's almost kind of shut down. It's so...
Yeah, it's just like the train is coming,
conclusion.
The train is
yes.
leaving, the lights are changing, my entire life is changing, but I can't focus on anything but these tiny little physical things, because the emotional and spiritual side of what's happening is too big to really talk about or comprehend, yeah.
It's also remarkable that, you know, Robert Johnson himself was only making music for what, like 7 or 8 years? It was less than a decade. This song is like less than 3 minutes long. But the legacy of what he did coming up with the Delta Blues, which emerged at the same time as the folk music out of Appalachia, you know, it's this legacy that he's left. And I'm sure, you know, been the foundation for a lot of the things that you love and you do has been immense, right?
Oh, yeah. And really happily so. You know, I don't know what I would do without that music. It's kind of the key for me that lets me interact with the world, literally. Sometimes I think people think that Dave and I chose this kind of music, and it's not really true. This is like the only way I really know how to move through the world and speak to the world.
Mm.
You know, this is it.
And I followed her to the station with a suitcase in my hand. And I followed her to the station with a suitcase in my hand. Well, it's hard to tell when all your love's in vain, all my love's in vain. When the train goes up to the station.
You folks going past Tishomingo?
Sure, hop in.
Robert Johnson's story also featured in an interesting way in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? There was a character in that was pretty much the story of Robert Johnson selling his soul to the devil.
Say, I haven't seen a house out here for miles. What are you doing out in the middle of nowhere?
Well, I had to be at that there crossroads last midnight to sell my soul to the devil.
Well, ain't it a small world, spiritually speaking? Pete and Delmer just been baptized and saved. I guess I'm the only one that remains unaffiliated.
This ain't no laughing matter, Everett.
What'd the devil give you for your soul, Tommy?
Well, he taught me to play this here guitar real good.
Oh, son.
And of course, you once again worked again with T-Bone Burnett on that soundtrack, which, for all the people who hadn't yet cottoned on to Gillian Welch and David Rawlings, all of a sudden your fandom and the people in the world all around just got cottoned on to bluegrass music in the year 2000.
Some bright morning when this life is over, I'll fly away to that home on God's celestial shore. I'll fly away.
The dawn of the millennium, this old-time music coming back. What was it like for you to be in the center of that whirlwind and all of a sudden be embraced by such a huge audience loving what you did?
Oh, it was truly, it was quite surreal, that whole phenomenon, because, you know, that what shaped that record was really mine and Dave's record collection. You know, that was kind of the basis for what became the musical cast and crew of Oh Brother.
Oh, wow.
And so to hear, after that record and that movie hit, to be walking down the street and hear some kid in downtown Detroit singing Man of Constant Sorrow was the craziest thing. I felt like my brain had cracked open and I was in some weird old-time dream.
I bid farewell to old Kentucky, the place where I was born and raised, the place where he was born and raised.
Who are you?
Well, sir, I'm Jordan Rivers, and these here are the Soggy Bottom Boys out of Cottonelia, Mississippi. Songs of salvation to salve the soul. We hear that you pay good money to sing into a can.
Well, that all depends.
It was very strange, because I remember when T-Bone started, and he had been contacted by the Coen brothers, and he had started working on Oh Brother, and he had gotten maybe, yeah, I think he'd gotten like 2,000 CDs of all this old-time music, and he had them all out on this table. I remember hearing, or maybe I saw it. I don't remember if we ever saw all the CDs, but he was just kind of voraciously trying to absorb all of this stuff as much as he could and listening to stuff and trying to find stuff to choose. But because, you know, through our connection to Nashville and the just the fact that this had been the stuff that we really, really loved, we had gotten a really nice picture of the people who were still active and who were making this music.
We're completely rooted in that deep tradition, but we're doing it.
But we're doing it presently, which ended up being the most important thing for putting together that soundtrack, was to, you know, to realize that John Hartford
and Norman Blake
and that Ralph, I mean, you know, T-Bone was familiar with the Stanley Brothers, but wasn't really familiar with the fact that Ralph was still making music, you know, at that moment. When all of these things that really did, I mean, not long before Oh Brother, I remember seeing Norman and Nancy Blake play in Nashville at, you know, a coffee house where we had played that you couldn't have put 50 people in, you know, and it was just very, very underground in that moment. And clearly primed for revival.
Yeah.
<You know?
laughs> Nicely put, dude.
And, of course, you take that on the road and perform it to places that held a lot more than 50 people. You mentioned Ralph Stanley as well, and the Stanley Brothers is another one of your choices in this theme of time. Ralph Stanley was the man who sang Oh Death from the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, an incredible, chilling, heartfelt performance of that.
Death, won't you spare me over till another year?
And way back in 1960, he, with the Stanley Brothers, released a wonderful song, a big hit called Rank Strangers. Tell me about why you chose this song and why you love it.
There's almost a dream quality to it. And it touches on kind of a primal fear of going back to a place that is so familiar and so beloved, and being a stranger. And I just gave myself goosebumps saying that.
I wandered again to my home in the mountain, where in youth's early dawn I was happy and free. I look for my friend, but I never could find them. I found they were all rank strangers to me.
That was a kind of a theme that turned up a lot in that era of music. You know, that kind of post-war, there were a lot of people who had gone away to the wars in the 40s and 50s and had come back to find where they had, you know, grown up, changed. And there were a lot of people who had, you know, moved from the Southeast maybe to work in the factories up north and then would be gone for 10 or 15 years. And, you know, there are songs like I'm on my way back to the old home or what have they done to the old home place. Like, this is a theme that comes up of returning home and just feeling this profound change of your past being erased or gone or feeling like a ghost.
Or either you're so different.
Yeah.
That, you know, does the place change or have you changed? But it's all related to the passage of time.
And again, such a big story in such a short song. There's so much emotional weight in this song.
Yeah.
You just summed up what I love about folk music.
Yeah.
My mother had a funny realization about that, because every time I'd come home for Christmas and I'd be baking or helping prepare Christmas dinner or something, I'd put some bluegrass record on, right? And I'd subject them to this. They loved music, but this was not their genre.
Subject them to it, yeah. Made me realize that, yes.
And finally, one year I was home and she said to me, you know, that music you play sounds really happy, but it's really sad.
That second verse of Rank Stranger, where it starts, you know, they've all moved away, and you think that they've moved somewhere in the physical world, and then you realize that what he's saying is everyone he's known is now gone,
has died.
To a beautiful home by the bright crystal sea. Some beautiful day, I'll meet him in heaven, where no one will be a stranger to me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit in Rank Strangers that's almost like, you know, a Twilight Zone episode. There's an element of, like, almost horror in it to just feel that
there
disconnected.
It's very like a movie or a novel also. It could also be a Thomas Wolfe book,
right?
The entire thing, you know.
And it's Kafkaesque in its way also, yeah.
You know what I think about in regards to Carter, Dave? I think we've talked about this, but not in a long time. He wrote so many songs, as he called them, mother songs, a lot of them about never being able to see his mother again, his mother being in heaven. And yet, Carter passed before his mother.
Mm.
So, it makes me remember, as true and as heartfelt as it is, it's art.
Yeah, he had a deep understanding of this kind of loss, and he wrote about it as well as anybody. And it wasn't, you know, I think a lot of people want everything that an artist does to come from personal experience. But, you know, the true artists are able to inhabit these experiences well enough that that it's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah,
I think that all the time, that you do have to live something, but you don't necessarily have to live it in the flesh. You can live it in your imagination.
I wandered again to my home in the mountain, where in youth's early dawn I was happy and free. mine. I found they were all rank strangers to me.
Everybody I met
seemed to be a rank stranger.
No mother or dad,
not a friend could I see.
They knew not my name,
and I knew not their faces.
Play this song first called Poncho and Lefty. Sorry about the air conditioners being off, but it won't be very long. If it gets really hot, I don't know what we'll do.
Your next choice is from the wonderful Towns Van Sant. Poncho and Lefty, live at the Old Quarter in Houston.
Now the poets tell how Poncho fell. Lefty's living in a cheap hotel. The desert's quiet and Cleveland's cold. So the story ends, we're told. Poncho needs your prayers, it's true. We'll save a few for Lefty too. He just did what he had to do. And now he's growing old.
Why did you choose this song, and in particular this version of this song?
That is a beautiful version. It's really raw and completely...
He starts the show with it, right? Which is so interesting.
That I can't remember. Is it the first?
I'm pretty sure he sits down and just starts singing Poncho and Lefty, which is also beautiful to think it's that song that he thinks of it as a calling card, but he doesn't think of it as something that he should hang on to until the end of the show. He just like sits down and plays a pretty understated version of it.
Yeah.
It's like Beyonce starting her shows with Crazy in Love, which she does do.
Right.
Like, I'm just going to come out all guns blazing.
Exactly. One of the moments in Poncho and Lefty that I find it takes you to a place that you don't think you're going to go is in the tag of the song where he's, you know, he's repeated the chorus. He says, all the federales say we could have had him any day. We're going to let him, I don't remember this version, if he says go so long or slip away out of kindness, I suppose, which is beautiful town sarcasm, you know, to let him sort of live with his own pain out of kindness. But then he repeats the line and he goes immediately to a few gray federales say we could have had him any day. And so we've now, within the course of 1 second in the song, we've gone from all the federales to a few gray, and the story has now moved, you know, 25, 30 years in the future, where most of the people even attached to the song have died off.
Yes.
And it's become a legend as opposed to a story. And that's staggering.
In his song, turns Lefty into a legend.
Living on the road, my friend, was gonna keep you free and clean. Now you wear your skin like iron and your breath's as hard as kerosene. You weren't your mama's only boy, but her favorite one, it seems. She began to cry when you said goodbye. Sank into your dreams. Poncho was a bandit, boys. His horse was fast as polished steel. Wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. But Poncho met his match, you know, on the deserts down in Mexico. And nobody heard his dying words. But that's the way it goes. And all the federales say they could have had him any day. They only let him hang around
out of kindness, I suppose.
Lefty, he can't sing the blues all night long like he used to do. I mean,
right.
It's just...
Yeah, it's tremendous.
It's an epic, really.
It's really interesting. Again, a very short song, but when you both sing this song and you've covered it many times before, you stretch it out to 7 minutes. And I wonder, when I was listening to that, I was thinking, in you doing that, I can sit in this story and the time that's passed a lot easier than in Townes' version, which is a beautiful version. But when, Dave, you play your guitar solos and stretch out that song, it gives you a chance to actually feel that time passing more so than Townes' version. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
Actually, there's one version I listened to recently where I was like, oh gosh, we played a solo even between the first two verses. And that was probably because it was one of the first times we played it and we couldn't remember what to do next. But
living on the road, my friend, is supposed to keep you free and clean. Now you wear your skin like iron, your breath is hard as kerosene. Weren't your mama's only boy, but her favorite one it seemed. And she began to cry when you said goodbye. Sank into your dreams.
I can tell you that that is why that happened, because I remember really clearly, and I remember thinking, oh, hell.
Right.
I meant to just turn it around, but I couldn't figure out how to do it.
So,
good cover.
It's an epic.
Yeah, it's an incredible song. And it's so beautifully captured, as you say, in this recording at the Old Quarter. You know, you have worked in the studio, you've recorded in a very stripped-back way, you've also expanded your sound with a lot more layering in instrumentation. When you choose to use live recordings in place of studio takes on albums, as you have done before, in Time the Revelator you did that, what's the ingredients that live in that live space that you just simply, no matter how stripped-back it is, that you just cannot capture in a studio?
Well, first of all, let me say, like, most of our recordings are live. They're just live in the studio.
Mm.
We just play, and that's the take.
But the sound of a big room, and, like, I remember on Time the Revelator, part of that choice, one was we couldn't get a version that good. So, you know, we're always going to use the best thing. But there was something incredible that happened when the applause happens for the guitar solo. Because that whole record is so, it's so myopic, it's so in your head, you feel so close to everything that the fact that
intimate.
All of a sudden, yes, that there's all of these other people. I always used to think of the version that Neil Young did of Needle and the Damage Done, where you don't know that it's live.
I've seen the needle and the damage done, a little part of it in everyone, but every junkie's like a setting sun.
And so you listen to this beautiful version, you feel like you're there alone with Neil, and then it closes down and there's this huge roar of people. And I remember as a little kid being shocked by it. Mm. Every time I would forget that I wasn't just there alone.
Like when we play, the audience is part of the show.
Mm.
You know, it affects how we play, just like the theater that we're in really affects the show. You know, we don't have in-ears in. We're not listening to monitors blasting up in front of us. We're listening to the room, and we're listening to the audience breathe and clap and cry. You know, I can hear people crying.
Your next choice is from the wonderful Carter family and Johnny Cash, Will the Circle Be Unbroken?
I was standing by my window
cold and cloudy day when I saw the hearse come rolling for to carry my mother away.
Why did you choose this song?
Well, this is one of those songs that has kind of been a touchstone for us for decades. We often talk about this song and sort of the perfection or near perfection of it. And it comes up again and again. Oftentimes I'll write in a notebook and I'll just jot down songs that I wished I'd written just to think about. And I have many notebooks that say, "Will the circle be unbroken?" I mean, first of all, how epic is that little piece of poetry?
Mm. Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky.
It's extraordinary. You know,
just because who even said it was a circle? You know, you're starting out with this beautiful, you know, a supposition that life or, you know, experience or reincarnation or whatever it is, that it's a circle to begin with. And then you're asking if it is a circle, that, you know, you're accepting the possibility that it could be broken. There's like it's absolutely baffling.
And it's beyond logic,
yes.
Which I think everyone immediately grasped. It seems to function on some other level. And also, Dave can attest to this. I'm very sensitive as a writer to temporality, to what tense we are in. Where are we? And in this song, we start in the past. I was standing by my window on a cold and cloudy day. And here we're past tense. He's telling what happened. And then wonders, in the future,
right,
will the circle be unbroken? And then, in the second verse, we are in present tense command. He's talking, Undertaker, Undertaker.
Right.
Undertaker, please drive slow. We're right there.
Right, so he's...
It's happening.
Yes, he's now sort of moved back from the... from the future into what may be a recollection. And it's really amazing that, right, will the circle be unbroken is this incredible way of saying, will I ever see my mother again?
That's right. But I remember when I was first getting acquainted with that song, that the Undertaker verse always jumped out at me. You know, and I didn't know, and it doesn't matter, but that present tense command is so powerful, you know.
Well, and the repetition of saying Undertaker three times.
Well, and then, yeah.
Yeah.
As that body you're carrying,
body.
Lord, I hate to see her go. I mean,
yeah.
Ugh.
I told the Undertaker, Undertaker, please drive slow, for this body you are hauling, how I hate to see her go.
It's so visual. It's as you say, you're right there.
Well, and it is very, very in the same category and group and kind of composition as Love in Vain.
Mm.
It is that economical and incisive. And just like, you know, you use words like economical or incisive, you talk about these songs and try to look at them with your analytical brain, but none of it matters. I mean, the fact is all of these songs just hit you on a gut level. And then you try to look at it and try to figure out why. But, you know, in some, I'm also willing to accept the fact that you'll never know why, and it just is.
Yeah.
I was standing by my window on one cold and cloudy day when I saw the hearse come rolling for to carry
we're talking a lot about the lyrics, but if you're talking about the Carters, harmony is at the heart of why they're so good. Families often harmonize quite easily with one another. There's something special about siblings harmonizing with one another. But for the two of you, how did you find your harmony together?
Oh, well, we had sung together for, I don't know, maybe a year, but always in the company of other friends of ours, you know, like in larger ensembles and at parties and stuff like that. And it wasn't really until we both moved to Nashville that we ended up in Dave's kitchen one night. And we sat in chairs facing each other and sang probably Rank Strangers. I know we sang Long Black Veil.
10 years ago on a cold dark night, there was someone killed neath the town hall light.
And that was the first time we heard our two voices together completely exposed, like just as a duet. And we didn't think it was great, but we thought it was good. You know, we thought we had a good natural blend.
So come on, you Asheville boys, turn up your time noise, kick till the dust comes up from the cracks in the floor. Singing high.
What do you love about what the other brings to a song that you write together?
I've never considered that because, I mean, there's a particular gravity, I think, that Gillian's always able to put into a song. And we really, it affects the way that we write and the way that, you know, we really sort of write towards that kind of delivery a lot of the time.
I kind of am the constant downward pull in our band, and Dave is sort of the upward pull, you know, in so many ways. And just in everything, he's often the one putting the energy into something. It's like if I'm the earth, he's lightning. And as far as our musical time too, you know, I'm so apt to settle on the backside of the beat, and you know, left to my own devices, things would sag and slow down. And Dave is much more likely to be on the front side of the beat. I don't know if that sounds like a small thing, but it's an extremely important thing that keeps our two-person band in balance.
That's harmony.
Yeah.
All of your songs that we've spoken about today, we've already said that, you know, there's tinged with sort of a melancholy and a sense of loss, but they're also very much about everyday lives, you know, and also hope. Hope for something more, hope for something better.
Make me an angel. Flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo.
And your final choice sees the late, great John Prine step into the shoes of a woman in a beautiful story. Tell me why you chose Angel of Montgomery.
I feel like John had listened to a lot of these songs that we're talking about previously and had felt the power that you get from contemplating a large piece of time and what it means for a life. And, you know, I always think that it's very interesting that he says, you know, I am an old woman to start the song, when truthfully someone had, after he had written Hello in There, which I'm pretty sure he wrote that song before he wrote Angel from Montgomery, I remember hearing him say that someone had come to him and said, you know, I love that song you did about, you know, about old people, which is a vast reduction, but it could, Hello in There. And, you know, I want to, let's write another song like that. And John said, no, I don't have anything else to say about old people. But he goes, but I've been, you know, but I have this idea about a middle-aged woman. And I like that even though he was coming at it as this, like, middle-aged song, that he started with the way the character felt, which is, I am an old woman, you know, relative.
She feels old. Mm.
Relative to her younger, mercurial self, yeah, that we sort of experience in the chorus.
I am an old woman, named after my mother. My old man is another child that's grown old.
And I heard that song when I was pretty young, you know. I think it instilled in me this feeling that it was difficult and dangerous to look back at your life. There was something in that song that kind of scared me, I think. It sounded heavy and kind of hard to process.
Again, that's the rare song that is focused in on one moment. It's just this person sitting in their kitchen wondering about how their relationship has changed and their life has changed and wanting anything to feel like life used to. And it's a, I mean, it's a very, very heavy,
very mature.
Yeah. And also interesting because John, who has this sense of humor in a lot of his songs, you know, I never, that song is as serious as songs come.
And he really was a big old goofy guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He
wasn't
really
this
was.
Like on his first record as well? So this is pretty early in his career that he's singing these kind of world-weary songs.
Well, he definitely came out of the gate with kind of the heaviest material thematically that he ever...
Sam Stone.
Yeah. I mean, that... and I think those are all songs that he was, you know, a lot of that he was writing when he was still a postal worker, like just walking and, you know, looking at the world and thinking at the world. And I also think that John, because by the time John Prine is coming on the scene, you know, there is this incredible singer-songwriter tradition that has started and has bloomed, and the bar has been set so high. And I really do think that John, as a young guy and an ambitious young writer, just came out swinging as hard as he could.
Yeah, like he wasn't going to pull any punches, just going to absolutely
right
tell it like it is.
Here and I mean, am.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am an old woman named after my mother. My old man is another child that's grown old. If dreams were lightning, thunder were desire, this old house would have burnt down a long time ago. Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can hold on to believe in this living is just a hard way to go.
Probably one of the first times I ever performed on stage, I sang that song.
Wow.
It was right around the time Dave and I would have met, and up in Boston at Berklee College of Music. Yeah, and actually, Bonnie Raitt was in the audience the night. Yes. Oh, yes.
Did
I had
you
to
know
sing that?
That?
Maybe like only the day before.
Oh, but you knew when you were standing there. Up there. That's terrifying.
Yes. Oh, it was awful.
And but she was a seasoned performer at school.
Oh, no, I'd only been on stage maybe like, you know, three times in my life. But she was so nice. She came right up to me backstage after the show, and she hugged me and said, "That was incredible." And I was shaking, and I asked her if she would sign my guitar. And she really hesitated. She's like, "Really? Are you sure? Are you sure you want my signature on your guitar?"
Wow.
I was like, "Yes, yes, please."
I love that. Well, everything is a circle. Time is a circle. We just keep on going round and round. Some things change, some things stay the same. And here we are coming full circle back to the very beginning, those early days where you stepped onto the stage, where the two of you met, where Bonnie Raitt signed your guitar. I love this. It's a beautiful way to end. And can I say, I've wanted to have this conversation with the two of you for a long time, and it's been even better than I could have dreamed of. So thank you so much for taking Five. This has been such a joy.
Oh, that's very sweet of you to say, and thank you for a theme that basically everywhere I looked, the songs, you know, fit into it.
That was special. I don't know about you, but sitting in their world, hearing them speak about songs, unpacking them, and even just marveling at their mystery, that felt like a deep meditation. That conversation was so moving to me, and I hope you loved it too. If you're new to their music, I hope this will send you down a rabbit hole of their extraordinary songs. And next time they tour, go see them. I promise it'll change your life. And if you know a Gil and Dave fan, send them this podcast episode. Thanks to every one of you who spreads the word. Next time, we're going to hang out with one of the most magnetic people I know.
I feel like audiences sometimes in Australia, they need to hear, wow, but they love it in America, so maybe I'll like it too.
Yeah.
Maybe it's actually good, quote unquote. That was not me saying that. That was me quoting someone I don't respect, a character that I've created that I don't respect in this moment.
Alexi Toliopoulos is a film nerd, but the way he talks about movies invites everyone along for the ride. You might know him from his Last Video Store podcast. Maybe you've seen him be funny on a panel show or even perform his new stand-up show. On Take 5, he'll be sharing the soundtrack to his life. That's next time.
Come hang out with your mates on Double J.
Loving great music is a lifelong passion.
And we're here to help you keep discovering.
Hello, it's Michael Hing from Double J Mornings.
It's Yumi Steins here.
It's Dylan Lewis from Arvo's on Double J.
Great music lasts forever, and you'll find it on Double J.
Somebody that you used to know, but you didn't have to cut me off.
We're on DAB Radio in your car, or just swipe across on the Triple J app.